We're gonna have a TV party tonight.
Alright!
We're gonna have a TV party, alright!
Tonight!
Saturday Night Live!
Alright, welcome back, everybody. Mick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday. It means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A little later on, we're going to be talking about the most memorable and most outrageous moments in late night TV. And we're going to talk about the best and most memorable fictional monarchs in honor of Archie. and that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, Triple Play Thursday request, and there you go. All right, it's time to talk with our friend Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a lot of TV to talk about, and so let's welcome Dan back to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, how you been?
Oh, just watching lots of TV. How about you?
I've been doing that as well, and other stuff. But I've been catching up on some TV and watching the regular stuff that I really enjoy. Let's start now because last we talked, there was this episode of Barry that that aired, and I so want to talk with you about the episode Ronnie Lilly, which I watched three times in one sitting. I've seen it five times now, and I can't even express how much I love that episode of television. It's unbelievable, and I'm sure you liked it.
That is some Teddy Perkins level of watching of that episode.
That's exactly what I thought of. Exactly what I thought of. I was like, that's the Teddy Perkins of this season.
Phew. Okay, I have not watched it that many times. I have only had the time to watch it twice, which felt like enough because I did want to watch it a second time. There was some, I guess maybe Tuesday or Monday of last week where I just had watched too much TV and there was nothing I wanted to watch. And so I plunked on that episode of Barry and noticed new things every second I was watching it, which is the same with Teddy Perkins. So absolutely.
I really thought that Hader made a statement as a director, with this one because he directed the hell out of it. For people who have not seen it, have not seen that episode, and it was 2 weeks ago, over 2 weeks ago, it's kind of a standoff episode. It's kind of a standalone episode. It still carries the plot along, but it just is. You know, Henry Winkler's not in it. Sarah Goldberg's not in it. NoHo Hank is not in it. It's just this insane episode where Bill Hader is sent, a police officer is blackmailing him into killing his ex-wife's new boyfriend, and it's just Hader and the new boyfriend, who turns out to be a Taekwondo master, and their confrontation, and then the confrontation with that Taekwondo master's incredible nut daughter. The only other regular character in it is Fuchs, it's beyond insane. I couldn't believe it when I was watching it. I thought the incredible long takes, the way that Hader choreographed the whole thing. And by the time the girl shows up, it just goes into another, dimension.
How I describe it to people is that it's a Coen Brothers movie in 31 minutes. That's how I would describe it. It is that kind of wacky violence, anything can happen, no particular rules of logic or gravity or fight choreography, just crazed, bizarre, magnificently timed humor and action. And it was the same night as the Game of Thrones episode that everybody was anticipating and everybody was talking about. And that episode was 82 minutes of being bludgeoned in the dark, and it was sometimes very effective and impressive and whatever, but watching just how consummately and meticulously crafted and how clean and neat this episode of Barry was, and how hilarious in a season that has really not been all that funny, this episode was a return to Barry being out and out, laugh out loud, hilarious, and it was funnier even the second time because there were so many things that I wasn't noticing the first time because my attention was on one corner of the frame and something else was happening elsewhere, or I wasn't paying attention to which things actually were all being done in one shot and which weren't. It was really an impressive episode.
It was incredible. It was really incredible. And I'm not a game... I don't watch Game of Thrones, as we talked about before, Dan, but even the Game of Thrones fans, including... my producer, Tom, who is a big Game of Thrones fan, everybody who I know who watches Game of Thrones said that Barry kind of pulled the rug out from under from under that much-hyped episode. Everybody was like, well, I didn't think Barry was going to be better than the episode of Game of Thrones that everybody had been talking about for 2 weeks.
I think there were some people who felt that way. I mean, I think if you go and you look at the actual numbers, probably 20 times the number of people watched that Game of Thrones episode as watched Barry episode. On the other hand, Game of Thrones has been benefiting Barry in the ratings significantly, which is a nice thing to see. It's so honestly, what I keep saying over and over again is how clean the episode of Barry was because of how murky and dark and crazed in a different way the Game of Thrones episode was, and just how much I appreciated the change of tone. And then this week's episode felt like more of a return to, I would say, late season one Barry, and that there were things that were funny and many more than in the first, say, three or four episodes of the season.
That one episode, the Ronnie Lilly episode, is obviously, you know, there's not going to be another episode like it during this season of Barry, because they got back to normal. As normal as Barry can be, as normal as that show can be, it went back to normal. And I knew that they would do that, because you can't do more episodes like that without just completely having people think the show's gone completely off the deep end. But there are just so many things about that episode that just kill me. I love the blood goatee. I can't even explain how much I love the blood goatee and the reveal that that Ronnie is still alive in the grocery store, and the look on the clerk's face when he sees Barry going looking for bandages. All of that stuff, it's just, and it's so beautiful. Like, as you said, it's so meticulously timed, and it was laugh out loud funny. But I gotta say, this girl, Jessie Giacomazzi, who is the daughter of stunt performers, the little girl was unbelievable. She was absolutely incredible, and I got a feeling we're gonna be seeing more of her.
I would hope that Barry would find a way to get her back at some point, having seen the reaction. No, I have one or two colleagues/friends who felt as if the episode and kind of the return to zany comedy kind of devalued some of the attempted seriousness that the show had built to in the first few episodes of the season. I don't know that I feel that way, but I do have colleagues who I respect who felt that way, and that's fine. I just viewed it as the show saying, this is a world and a sensibility that still exists and that we can still play around with, and just because we've shown that we can go more serious does not mean that that's what the entire world is. And, you know, just because we've made it look like there's this one outsized corner of the world in NoHo Hank and his various expressions and whatever, doesn't mean that there aren't other corners of absurdity still to be explored. Right. I appreciated that.
I just loved it. And Stephen Root is, you know, well, he's a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. And he is so hilarious in that episode. Just so funny. He's funny all the time, but he's particularly funny. And his line reading on "What are you?" is just one of my favorite moments of the TV season. That episode just kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't aware that there was going to be an episode like this. There was no hype about it. I just thought it was going to be another really good episode of Barry, and what 5 minutes in, I'm like, what do we got here? So it was a wonderful surprise.
I knew it was coming because several of my colleagues had sort of hinted on Twitter that that week's Barry was a little crazy and that it was a bit of a change of pace. So I knew something was coming, but even knowing that was coming, I would not have expected the episode as it unfolded.
Now, the expected Emmy nominations for this show come out. If they want Hader to get a director nomination, that's the episode to submit, correct?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I assume they will. I assume they know. But then again, I think you get to, I feel like you get to submit multiple directing episodes.
Oh, okay.
I would assume that that is one that they will definitely be submitting. And it definitely got more discussion than most of the season so far. And they would be fools not to recognize what a good episode it was for Hader as a director. I think the previous episode was actually probably better for Hader as an actor. But
yeah,
that's a preference.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. We're going to get to that. I promise we're going to get to new TV. But I hadn't talked to Dan since it aired. And it's like my favorite television episode like ever. One of my favorite television episodes ever. So we had to talk about it. All right. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll dive into more TV. Dan Feinberg is with us. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Joins us every 2 weeks. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More after the news. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in right now. We'll play them later. That's one artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about the most memorable and outrageous late-night moments, late-night TV moments. And in honor of Archie, we will be talking about some of the best and most memorable fictional monarchs of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Right now, we're talking TV. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter joins us every 2 weeks. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We bring Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
You know, we were looking at some of your tweets, and I mentioned Archie. And I'm sure you probably don't know this. I've probably never spoken to you about this, but The Chocolate War is like my favorite book of all time. And I got it from we were talking about Teacher Appreciation Week the other morning. And I mentioned when my eighth grade teacher, her name was Miss Nagel, and I was a voracious reader when I was younger. And I was leading our class in book reports. I had the most book reports of anybody. So at the end of the year, right before I graduated, elementary school, she gave me a copy of The Chocolate War and said, "I think you should read this book." And it was a game changer for me. It taught me not to trust authority, not to question anything that any adults say. It taught me, and I know this sounds like a negative, but it taught me to be cynical. And it was a book that literally sort of changed the way I thought of things. And it's right up there with Catcher in the Rye as a life-changing book. And the fact that you referenced in your tweet, you referenced Archie Costello is unbelievable to me. So to explain The Chocolate War reference, Dan.
I would have to give the entire plot of The Chocolate War, right, but Archie Costello is the assailant in The Vigils, group of basically the group that runs this prep school in The Chocolate War. And it is legitimately, when I hear Archie, first I really and truly do think of Archie Andrews, but I think of Archie Andrews from the glory days of the Archie comics and not from Riverdale.
Right.
So that is still who I think of legitimately in first. And then I saw a lot of people in my Twitter feed posting pictures of Cary Grant because of his real name.
Right.
And I'm just like, someone needs to mention Archie Costello from The Chocolate War.
I love that, Dan. I love that.
Darn it, I did. The high school that I went to in northern Massachusetts was the high school that Robert Cormier went to. And so,
oh, is that right?
Indeed. And so Leominster High School, Leominster, Massachusetts, represent. So he's kind of worshipped as a god there, and for logical reasons. He's a great, one of the great YA novelists ever, and he wrote other very, very good books, but The Chocolate War is the pinnacle.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously dug into everything he wrote after I read The Chocolate War, but now I got to ask you, what did you think of the Keith Gordon movie?
I don't think it's very good, because they couldn't do it. You just couldn't. What I told someone on Twitter today was that someone with guts should attempt to do it as a 6-part or 8-part miniseries now on a streaming service. I think Amazon or something, where you can actually do the brutality of the Robert Cormier ending, and where you can actually have the cynicism that that book has, and just the bleak worldview, because you just couldn't do that in the movie at the time it came out. It's got a, you know, it's got a great cast.
It's got a great cast, and I think there are moments in it. I think John Glover is great in it as Brother Leon. I think he's great. And you know, it's got a really good cast, and I think there are moments in it that I really like. But I was so angry by the end of the movie, I wanted to punch Keith Gordon in the face. And I don't mean that ironically. I'm just saying, like, I was so angry about the change that they made. Completely upending what that book was about. You know.
You could not do it. And I'm not 100% convinced you could do it today in an actual studio-supported movie. I think maybe if you could somehow do it independently, that would be one thing. But no, I'm not sure you could do it today.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if an Amazon were to get behind it, someone on Twitter again, plus Twitter, suggested Bob Odenkirk as Brother Leon, and I am 100% on board with that.
That would be great, yeah.
So to me, it feels as if basically the movie happened but didn't exactly happen, and certainly didn't tell the story in the way that it needed to be told.
Right.
So I would love for someone to attempt to bring that back and see what they could do, because I think it's essentially a timeless story. It's that good and that resilient a narrative.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just found it unbelievably cool that you mentioned Archie Costello. I just want to see. Yeah, for is there another reason why I can like Dan Feinberg more? There it is.
So some of my tweets are probably for like a dozen people. But I'm always happy when they hit home.
Well, trust me. I just went whoa when I saw that tweet. So very cool. All right, I just dug into Dead to Me. I started watching it yesterday, and I'm about four episodes in. And I really, really like it. And I know that you had a review of it. This is a tough one to talk about, though, Dan, as you know.
It is. It's a much easier one to talk about it now than it was before it premiered, because the list of do not spoils that Netflix sent to critics was as frustrating as I have ever experienced outside of something like Mad Men, where Matt Wiener's letters were always sort of legendary for the things that we couldn't reveal, including what year it was and whether people were still knew each other. We couldn't do that. But this, it was this whole list of things that to my mind weren't spoilers, or to my mind were spoilers only of the first episode and a half of a 10 episode series, etc. So yeah, it's a tough one to talk about.
It is.
But for those who don't know, the show stars Christina Applegate as a woman whose husband died in a hit and run that has never been solved. At her grief counseling group, she meets another woman who says that she's mourning her lost fiancé. That woman is played by Linda Cardellini. They become friends, but there are lots and lots of secrets, and things become involved.
Right, and I think that's as far as we can go with it. I really do. I'm only four episodes in. I'm not even halfway through the season, and there have been more surprises and twists in it, although some of them you could see a mile away. A lot of the twists aren't all that surprising, but they're really well done. And I can't, even going into this, I was going to be biased because I adore both of these women. They're two of my favorite actresses, and I love them so much, and they're both great in the show.
In my review, I described the mystery aspect of the plot, or the thriller aspect of the plot, as kind of gravy, and I described it as gravy that you put on an ice cream sundae.
Right.
because, look, the two actresses are wonderful, and they are so good. And the way that the show discusses female friendship, and the way that the show discusses grief, and how you move forward in your life when everything is reminding you of the person and the thing you lost, and all of that, it does those things so well. And yet, the twists and the cliffhangers are kind of what propels the story along, and I don't really know that they're necessary, and yet it's what gets people to watch and to keep watching. So it's hard to know how to handle it, because I think that it's by far the weakest aspect of the story, the twists and the cliffhangers. But I guess you need it there. And so if that gets people to watch a show that has these two wonderful lead performances and that has things to say of value, then I guess it's the price to pay. And it does, you know, it pushes you along episode to episode without any question.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I agree with you 100% about that statement. I really do. And I can't say enough about Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. They're both so great singularly in the show and especially together. It's so much fun to watch those two in doing scenes together. And I also want to mention, and I don't know the kid's name, and I feel like a jerk, her older son in the show I think is fantastic. I think he's really, really good and brings a lot to it. And Ed Asner's in it, for God's sake. Come on, you know?
Well, I mean, Ed Asner was also in the first season of Cobra Kai, for heaven's sake. So sometimes Ed Asner just likes to work. And Ed Asner is so well deployed here, and it's such a reminder that very few people hit punchlines like Ed Asner does.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
By all means, no. It's James Marsden is great in it, though. Certainly, seeing anything at all specific about his character was part of what we were instructed not to spoil.
Right.
I'm not going to. Basically, I think my review just acknowledged he was in the show.
Right.
Which, to my mind, really dramatically shortchanges him. I think that, as a result, people weren't able to say how very good he is in their reviews because Netflix wanted to step in and make it all twisty and stuff. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's. I think, you know, these. It was. I was just very excited for these two women who I've always loved. I mean, I've loved Linda Cardellini since Freaks and Geeks. I even like her in the Daddy's Home movies, for God's sake. So, and Christina Applegate has been a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, since Married with Children. And to see them have, like, really juicy roles like this is really gratifying and a lot of fun. So I'm really enjoying the show, and I'm going to finish it probably in a day or two. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. That show that we were just talking about is called Dead to Me. It's on Netflix, and it's I highly recommend it. I'm four episodes in, and I think it's pretty great. And we didn't talk about a lot of it because there's a lot of twists and turns in it. So, okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more TV talk with Dan after this. Good morning. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. We are talking TV right now with Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every other week. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a lot of TV to talk about. Let's get Dan back in here. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
I have not seen the show yet. Again, this is another Netflix show. I have seen one sketch, and it's called I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. I've only seen one sketch because I have a friend who sent a link to me because he knows how much I love Vanessa Bayer. And so it was the Vanessa Bayer sketch with the Instagram, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. And I became a big Tim Robinson fan because of Detroiters, which was a show that I thought was unbelievably funny. And it was one of those deals where you discover, like Michaela Watkins and like Jenny Slate, how underused, incredibly talented people have been in the past on SNL. And Tim Robinson made me realize that when I saw Detroiters. And so I really think the guy is great. What do you think of I Think You Should Leave?
The thing I like most about it, if I'm being perfectly honest, is that the episodes are only 15 minutes long.
Right.
So if you haven't actually dug into it, you can be done with it in less than 2 hours.
Okay.
It goes by very fast. And look, if I'm being honest, I've seen four of the six episodes. I think it is somewhat repetitive, and maybe that doesn't necessarily go so well with a show that's designed to be binge watched. And so, you start noticing that there are certain words that he just finds really, really funny, most of which I can't say on the radio.
Right.
He definitely gets a kick out of them, and certain kind of images that he likes doing, and certain build-ups and crescendos that he likes doing. But it is definitely funny, and it goes by so fast that even if a sketch is repetitive and not all that clever, it's on to the next one before you notice it, on to the next episode. So, I think that it's we did not review it because it just sort of snuck onto Netflix to some degree. They did give us screeners, but just was never pushed aggressively. But it's one of the things that Netflix has been doing more recently. They had the comedy special, which was all episodes between 11 and 17 minutes. They had the S&M comedy Bonds, which I haven't watched yet, but I hear is somewhat comparable in terms of really short episodes. And it's a thing that Netflix should be doing, where they say, okay, sometimes things really only need to be 15 minutes per episode or whatever. It obviously has to cap costs. It has to encourage people to just keep watching, because you're almost surprised when it gets to be 15 minutes of the first episode. You're like, hey, it's over. Okay, might as well watch the second episode. I allotted 30 minutes of my time. So I think it's good. I think you will really, really like it. If you've been, you will start to notice that certain things, he goes back to certain wells fairly frequently, and maybe the second season, who knows. But so many of his various SNL friends, apparently he made a lot of friends while he was on SNL, but probably he knew them before from the improv world.
Sure.
But lots of familiar people, in addition to Vanessa Bayer, pop up frequently. It's, he's got funny friends, and he's fairly funny, and there are good sketches and bad sketches, but even the bad sketches go by fast.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it. I didn't know about, like you said, I didn't know about it at all until that person sent me the clip that sent me the sketch with Vanessa Bayer, and I was like, what is this show? I didn't even know about it. So I didn't know that they were 15 minutes. I can knock that thing out today.
it goes by very, very fast. Okay. Again, I've watched four. I think it's only six episodes total.
All right.
Gone.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. All right. Now, we'll stick with Netflix again, and this is a BoJack Horseman spinoff, Tuca and Birdie?
It is not a BoJack Horseman spinoff, but it definitely looks and feels a fair amount like BoJack Horseman. It is created by Lisa Hanawalt, who was the lead cartoonist, production designer, eventually executive producer on BoJack Horseman, and she created Tuca and Birdie and wrote the pilot script with Raphael Bob Waxberg, who created BoJack Horseman, and most of the directors and several of the writers, et cetera, also come from BoJack. But it feels simultaneously very similar, because it looks a lot like BoJack, because it's the same animator, but the feeling is very different. The premise of this one is that, the premise of BoJack is a manic depressive horse who's right. constantly isolating himself and making him alone,
right.
whereas the premise of Tuca and Birdie is these two lifelong friends who are also birds. One is a toucan, one is a songbird, voiced by Tiffany Haddish and Ali Wong. And they're just friends in a fictional city, again, a contrast to the Hollywood of BoJack Horseman.
Right.
And it's full of big colors, fun, life, large fits of whimsy, the kind of thing that BoJack just can't do, because its hero is so internalized and so frequently miserable and so part of the Hollywood machine, and so everything revolves around that for BoJack. This, it's wide open. The animation does all sorts of crazy things just because it can. So, okay, fine, a brief claymation sequence, why the heck not? A brief puppetry sequence in which you can see the person's hand in the scene, sure, why not? A scene that looks like retro computer animation, sure, why not? It does a lot of things. It's not as intellectual as BoJack. It's much more about feelings and emotions. It's also, like Dead to Me, it is a show about female friendship, so if you feel like you miss Broad City, it's a lot like Broad City, and if you watch these characters, you'll see how these two characters are really a lot like Abby and Alana, and their friendship is a lot like Abby and Alana's friendship, and the sort of the backdrop of women needing each other as friends, because having friends is a good thing, while also trying to move on with their lives in other ways. It's it's a significant and meaningful backdrop, and I think there's a lot to really, really enjoy about this show. It takes it maybe 30 minutes, you know, the first episode, to kind of get over the, wait, why is this not BoJack? Why are the jokes not BoJack jokes, et cetera, et cetera. But the show itself is a real pleasure to watch.
Okay, great. That's great. So people are going to bring baggage to it because they're going to think it's BoJack, and it's not.
And also because the BoJack audience, BoJack will presumably skew more male, more sort of sardonic, sarcastic, grumpy, you know, which I resemble very frequently. And so you watch this, and it's touchy-feely, it's joyful, it's playful in a entirely different way, and yet, you know, they go into a bookstore, and you can still look at the cover of every single book and keep pausing, and see the 55 jokes, the 75 puns. It still has that kind of humor. It's just not the only thing the show is. It's also not the only thing the show is on BoJack either. Right. BoJack is a great show, obviously. Yeah. I love me some BoJack. I just think this is a very good show that requires people accept that it's not BoJack, even though it looks and sometimes feels like BoJack. Okay.
There you go. That's Tuca and Birdie, which is it streaming now, right?
Yes, it is now available on Netflix.
There you go. Tuca and Birdie. That's another one I got to put on my list. Hey, apropos of nothing, Dan, before we break here, did you watch last night's Daily Show with Trevor?
I have not yet.
Okay.
But I will.
Okay. I don't know if I've laughed harder at anything that Trevor Noah has done this year, but he unearths a bunch of footage from a 1980s local Vermont cable TV show that Bernie Sanders hosted. And it is, I don't know if I've laughed harder at anything that the Daily Show has done this season than this. And it's funny mostly because of the footage. The footage is unbelievable, but also because of Trevor's reaction to it. It's the top story after the headlines in the first segment of the show, and it's hilarious. I didn't know whether you had watched it or not, but I was crying with laughter while watching it.
I will be watching that probably with caffeine in the morning. And apropos of the same nothing, have you watched last night's What We Do in the Shadows?
No, it's on my DVR. As soon as I get home, I watch it, and that's immediately
guaranteed to blow your mind.
Is it right? Because I'm enjoying. I know that you run hot and cold on the TV series. I'm really enjoying it. I'm glad it got renewed. And the projectile vomiting sequence from last week. I don't know if I've where the Baron is just flying and smashing into buildings while projectile vomiting after eating the pizza. I just thought it was hilarious.
I've liked the last few. I hated the werewolf episode. I thought it was just awful, and it really made me concerned. And I'm like, oh no, I'm turning on the show entirely. I thought the last couple were really good, and last night's episode is tremendous.
Okay, great. I can't wait. It's the first thing I'm going to do when I get home. Okay, Dan, hang on. Okay.
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We have to break here, and we'll come back. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and at Facebook on The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. And we got the news coming up, and then afterwards we'll jump right back into TV Talk with Dan. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're back. And how are you doing? It's a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. We'll play them later. That's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. And we're going to be talking about some of the more outrageous and memorable moments in late night TV. And we're going to talk about great fictional monarchs and much more. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. Let's get back to our talk about TV. Every 2 weeks, Dan Feinberg joins me, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's get back to the conversation. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So you had a kind of a roundtable discussion, you guys, about the best spring shows. Let's touch upon that. It was you and Tim Goodman.
The basic thesis was the only things that anybody is talking about on TV are basically Game of Thrones and maybe Veep and Barry on the side. are there still television shows that people need to be watching, or was all the oxygen sucked out of the room by these HBO juggernauts, and we came to the shocking conclusion that, yes, there are other good shows on TV? Stunning, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, what did you guys, what were some of your choices that are not HBO related?
Ah, see, and since I feel like we've only talked about Netflix on this conversation so far, I'm going to talk a little bit about Hulu now,
okay.
Because, you know, it's important to have other streaming services also. Hulu's just had a great spring, and we kind of made fun of Hulu when they moved Handmaid's Tale out of the way of Game of Thrones because they knew it was going to get crushed at the Emmys, and they were probably correct to do that, but Hulu's spring has included The Act, which I still need to finish, but is a really good, twisted, weird, true crime thing that will surely get Emmy nominations for Patricia Arquette and Joey King.
Yes.
And then they have these three comedies that have all now been renewed, I believe, and that all have these distinctive voices, and even if they aren't fully put together necessarily immediately, in some cases they are. So there's Shrill. Have you watched Shrill yet?
I have not.
I know.
It's a big hurdle for me to get over, considering how I feel about Eddie Bryant. But
I understand it's only six episodes, yeah, but it's also, of the three, the least good to my mind. So, like, I want to tell you that you need to watch because you want to apologize to Eddie Bryant. But
okay.
But it's not the one I would tell you to watch first. I don't remember. Have we talked about Pen 15? Have you watched
Pen 15? No, we haven't talked about it.
Okay. You really should watch Pen 15, or as I'm prone to calling it, Hulu's penis, because that's the joke. It's just this quirky, strange comedy where the premise is that the two creators, or co-creators, Anna Conkle and Maya Erskine, who are actresses in their upper 20s, lower 30s, are playing 13-year-old kind of versions of themselves, and the rest of the cast is all real middle school actors. And that is the premise, and it sounds like a gimmick, and occasionally it is a gimmick, but it's also just this really exposing look at being a middle school student and at growing through puberty, and kind of it sort of tears apart this is the most awkward moment of your life and it gets better, because it puts these two people who have gone through the it gets better, and it's putting them back in this world. So it's really great. But the best of the three Hulu comedies, and I mentioned this to you on Facebook when you were waxing rhapsodic about Barry, is Rami.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten to it yet. And you mentioned you mentioned episode four, correct?
Episode four is the big episode, and I'm saying no more about it than that. You obviously have to go through the first three to get there. But it's a remarkable first season of a show. It really is, because it is a show just about a 20-something Muslim man living in New Jersey who wants to be young and have fun, but also wants to follow his religion. And it's not in any way the narrative that you expect from a show like this, where the narrative is he's got these disapproving parents and he doesn't want any part of the religion and he wants to be a modern American and blah blah blah, and it's this huge imposition that he has to be religious. No, he wants to observe his faith. He wants to fast on Ramadan. He wants to pray five times a day, etc. He also wants to hook up with women and other things. But it's just a really, it's the kind of show that people, when they say, why does no one ever talk about religion on TV? Why does TV ignore religion? Well, those people also are going to be completely ignoring this show, which is as earnest, but also frequently incredibly funny, a show about religion as TV has had in years. It is so assured and so confident in its storytelling. And while the fourth episode is the standout episode, and will be a contender for best of the year lists, the show just gets better as it goes along and just does all of these risk-taking things with storytelling and with character, and I just admire it so much. So So while there have been other good things this year on other networks, Hulu's had a great spring, and that was one of the things that I made sure that we concentrated on in the back and forth piece that started this long celebration of Hulu's spring.
There you go. All right. And it's available at the Hollywood Reporter, and it's the debate of the best spring shows, shining a light on some of the shows that maybe you haven't seen before or weren't aware of. So there you go. All right. So what do you think now? You know, we'll jump into something else, but how are you feeling about Game of Thrones so far?
I thought this week's episode was borderline brutal, and
not just because of the coffee cup.
If it is so strange to me that we are in the home stretch of one of the biggest shows in recent television history. This was the anti-penultimate episode. It is the over the halfway point in this season, and the thing that people have been talking about for the past 3 or 4 days is the stupid coffee cup.
Right.
But part of why people have been talking about the stupid coffee cup is because if you talk about the episode itself, you get stuck talking about all the stupid things the characters did in the episode and all of the frustrating things that the writers did to the characters that kind of tore so many of them asunder. So, yeah, there was that coffee cup, and you know, I don't understand how that happens. I've seen people, I think Trevor Noah made a joke, ha ha ha, about a PA who made a mistake and was going to get their head cut off. Yeah. And like, ha ha ha, whatever. But, you know, anyone who knows anything about how TV works knows that it wasn't a PA who made the mistake. It was like 200 people.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 of course.
Who made the mistake.
Yeah.
And it starts with a script supervisor or a director or the cinematographer, all of whom presumably were looking at the scene and didn't pay attention. Every actor who was in the scene didn't pay attention.
Yeah.
But there had to have been a dozen people who have been working nonstop to be editing this episode, and somehow none of them noticed there was this stupid coffee cup in the frame. I don't know how it happens, but I guess it beats talking about how the show sold out half of its female characters this week. So, yay.
Yeah, that was a big, my producer Tom watches it, and he felt the same way about the portrayal of the female characters in it. And it wasn't happy about it. So
it was a mess, and it was disheartening because there are two episodes left.
Yeah.
There are two episodes left, and you can't have with two episodes left fans as unhappy as they were after this last episode. And I went from, my excitement has dwindled as we get closer and closer to the end, because I become more and more convinced as we get towards the end that wherever it's going to end is not going to make me happy. And so where I am.
Okay. Well, let's end the conversations with our bi-weekly mention of Better Things. a show that is consistently fantastic and maybe the best on TV. And last week's episode again was pretty extraordinary. Made me cry. It's just a great, great show. We have to mention Pamela Adlon every time we visit. Would you agree, Dan?
I am happy to do so, and also entirely happy to end on a positive note, because it was yet another great episode and sort of began to get us into some depth on how the show has kind of become this vaguely supernatural show this season. Because Sam's father, Pamela Adlon's character's father, has been popping up for a scene a week, basically as his ghost, and it hasn't been explained. But, the show has made great use of Olivia Edward this season.
Yeah.
She plays Duke, Sam's youngest daughter, and they've just gotten so much value out of her, which you can never count on doing with a young actor.
Yeah.
And this week, the scene with the sandwich was
God. Oh, my God.
it was a little bit disturbing. It was a whole lot sad.
Yeah.
And it was just, you just sat there and went, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just such a great show. I look forward to it every week. So, all right, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. And a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. And you're working on, what are you going to be posting up next? Any other reviews coming up?
Well, the thing is, next week is Upfronts week. So next week is going to be a non-stop fiesta of new programs, trailer reviews, sort of how networks are rearranging their schedules. So that is the thing that is kind of on tap for next week. Okay. That's going to make next week utter chaos.
All right. Well, we'll cover the whole thing the next time you're on, okay?
It will be perfectly timed in 2 weeks. Looking forward to
it. Perfect. All right. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too.
Okay. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we'll talk to him again in a couple of weeks. Take a break right now here on 720 WGN.